This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Once television seemed like a fortress impregnable, a lighthouse beamed directly, reliably into nearly every American home. On an ordinary Sunday evening, say November 22nd, 1987 in Chicago, TV was predictability itself, firmly controlled by its anointed gatekeepers, until that control was stolen twice in one night. First, when a man in a Max Headroom mask silently broke into the broadcast of the 9 o'clock news, and then when he intruded into an 11 p.m. broadcast of Doctor Who.
The creature has got into the lighthouse. Now we must fight for our lives.
That clip was from that fateful episode of Doctor Who, but here's what that actual interruption sounded like. When the Max Headroom man with a fixed leer spoke with a voice deliberately distorted, he executed a series of creepy antics, culminating in pulling down his pants and howling, while a man in an apron slapped his naked bottom with a fly swatter. Chicago TV producer Boas Blauhut was a kid back in 1987.
I was quite wigged out. You know, did I pick up an errand signal from Mars? Was this from the future? This shock, you know, you're taken out of a super cheap BBC drama and suddenly brought into somebody's garage.
Maybe he was picking up something from the future, some 25 years into the future, when TV's traditional order is disrupted and flickering images penetrate your home from everywhere and everyone across a variety of platforms. The truth is, many TV consumers are wigged out, bewildered by the multitude of options in 2012. That's why we're devoting this hour to the agitated, unruly business of television.
In a less confusing time, not so many years ago, couch potatoes basically fell into two camps: cable satellite watchers and folks who stuck to network TV. Now you can get your TV via a monthly cable package or via satellite or through online services like Hulu or through piracy or by peering into the window of your neighbor's house. Of course, depending on how and where you watch, your bill will vary widely and your money will flow every which way. Peter Kafka covers the TV industry for the website All Things D. We asked him to come on the show and play the part of a TV magnate or a cable king, and to tell some TV viewers on the staff which among us he'd like to marry and which he'd tie to the railroad track. Peter, welcome to OTM.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Are you twirling your mustache?
If you wanted me to emulate a cable baron, I could try to do that, but I'm not nearly as wealthy as one.
So we've got these three kinds of viewers. Katya Rogers, our senior producer, what do you do?
I'm the perfect customer. I don't take anything for free. I have my Time Warner cable bill. I have my internet on there. It's $130 a month, I think. I have Netflix subscription. I have a Roku. Constantly buying on iTunes. I just throw money out the window. I just don't even keep track.
I, for one, not only pay for direct satellite TV, but I pay for Time Warner internet broadband. PJ Vogt, who is the lead producer on this hour, how do you consume television?
I don't think I'm the industry's best friend. Like, sometimes I'll pick up a Netflix subscription and then stop paying for it and put it back down. I'll stream things and I'll skip the ads. And if anything's at all hard for me to get, I'll just download it for free.
Me, Kat, and PJ. Which do you, hypothetical TV executive, prefer?
Katya, right?
Yes.
Am I getting that correct? You're the full boat. That's great. Please consume as much as you can. We're a little freaked out that you're using services that don't come directly from us. But the truth is, when you're watching things on iTunes and Hulu and Netflix, you're really just making more money for our partners. And we think we've figured out a way to sort of keep that in check. You're only going to watch stuff that's already been on TV before. You can't directly threaten our existing ecosystem. So that's great. And Brooke, if I'm an old-time cable guy, I don't like the fact that you're using a newfangled satellite dish. We would have preferred to have no competition at all. But we lost that battle about 10, 15 years ago. If we add in the dish guys, if we add in the new guys from Verizon and AT&T, we're all still working in the same system, and that's fine, too. Just keep paying your bill. And PJ, you really freak us out. because we think you might stop paying for video altogether one day. We won't say that publicly, at least not while we're still running these companies. If we're on our way out, we might say that cord cutting is real. The CEO of Verizon said that as he was leaving. Here's the good news for us, the cable guy, by the way. All of you, you're still going to pay me to get on the internet.
We also have a member of the staff who will be left unnamed, who basically pirates all of the TV that he watches. We left him out because we figured you'd given up on him.
No, he's still paying us, by the way. He's not getting his broadband for free. He may be getting the content for free, and that's bad for us because it hurts our partners, and our partners make a lot of money for us. But all of those movies you're stealing, they take a lot of bandwidth, and you're going to pay us for bandwidth. And we are now moving towards a system, us being all of the cable guys collectively across the nation, towards something called usage-based billing, which is the more stuff you consume, the more we're going to charge you. The idea that you pay us 50 or 60 bucks a month and you get to eat all the internet you want, that's going away too.
Peter, I feel like when I talk to Brooke and Kat, I feel like they're in a world that I totally don't understand because everyone that I know is doing what I'm doing. You know, they're not paying for very much. They're getting around ads. It seems crazy to me that Brooke and Kat would spend like over $100 a month for something that you can very easily get for free.
What do you spend a month on cable?
I chip in. I've got three roommates. I think I'm paying like 20 bucks a month.
So again, the cable guys assume that at some point you move out on your own, get your own place, that at some point you'll come to your senses and you'll say, my time is worth more than my money and all this going and hunting and fetching. It's too much work. I'm just going to bite the bullet and pay for cable and I'm going to pay that 120 bucks a month.
They're betting that one day I'll be a grown up.
Yeah. I'm going to guess that maybe you're 25.
Yeah.
They would have liked for you to have already grown up. Because that's traditionally the expectation was you'd be signing up for cable after college. You haven't done that. None of your friends have. That freaks them out. But they're hoping that maybe by the time you hit 30, you'll shape up and join in.
Okay, Peter, I have a question. Does it matter that I've never seen an ad? Never.
Nor do I ever watch them.
Yeah, and I've got ad blocking software. So even when I stream stuff on Hulu, I just browse to some other tab while it sort of blacks out for 2 minutes.
Yeah, Brooke and Katya, it matters that you haven't seen an ad. But the TV, broadcast, cable, all the ad businesses, except for the internet, is right now in this sort of mutual, agreed, delusionary state where they all agree that we all know no one's watching many ads. But we all sort of seem to think it works. It works better than any other system we have for getting marketing messages to you. By the way, we're pretty sure that you actually are seeing some ads. You're just not aware of it. In fact, we think that when you're fast-forwarding through the ads on the DVR, Katya, that we're going to charge a premium for the ads we run at the beginning of the commercial break and at the end of the commercial break.
It's true. You always get stuck on that last one.
You're going to get stuck. And by the way,
yeah.
We've started designing ads so that even as you're fast-forwarding, you're going to see the message because we've got a bar at the top or the bottom of the screen that says, this is the advertising message you're skipping past. And by the way, advertisers are still spending more money on TV advertising by a huge margin than they are on the internet where they really can target it directly to you.
Does the vast majority of TV viewership look like me? Or like Kat or like PJ?
I don't know. I don't think the cable guys know. I think if you live in New York, if you live on the West Coast, technology hubs, if you're on college campuses, it might look a whole lot like PJ is sort of the wave of the future. You know, they'll keep selling to you, Brooke and Katya, because you're not going anywhere. You're not really going to change your habits. The real worry is that 5, 10, 15 years out from now, the PJs of the world are now the majority.
The idea that when I'm 30, I'll be like, ah, it's just too much trouble to Google something and click download. I don't find pirating very hard. Like, do they have a plan B where they just charge me way more for... I mean, that's basically it, right? They just charge me a lot more for internet?
Yep, that is the plan. If you refuse to get with the system and refuse to pay for cable like a responsible grown-up, you will pay for broadband.
Seems that TV's in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
Why?
More than records, more than
definitely
publishing.
More than music. More than publishing.
More than newspapers.
More than newspapers. All the other industries we've covered the death of.
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting things about my beat. I mean, there's an article of faith among the digerati that the internet disrupts everything. It's all inevitable. What happened to music is what will happen to the TV and Hollywood guys. And like you point out, it hasn't happened. It might still happen. But one gut feeling I've got is that people, and this is very disappointing as someone who works for newspapers and likes music, is that people value TV a lot more than they did those other products. And they're willing to pay for it. They value it much more. They value it so much they don't even think about it unless it goes away. If your cable goes out for a day, you're furious, right? If your newspaper didn't come for a day or if you couldn't get a CD for a day, you'd find a way to move on. But if you can't watch TV, you freak out.
It's kind of depressing.
unless you're in the TV business. And by the way, let's admit, right? There's awesome TV.
Yes.
I cannot tell you how excited I am to watch some shows. Yeah, there you go.
It's the best ever. Peter Kafka, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Kafka is a reporter for All Things D, and you can learn all about the media from going to that site. But for our purposes, he played the TV industry.
I'm thinking of switching more to the PJ model.
Yeah, you don't want to go back to like four people crammed in a tiny Greenpoint apartment.
It's romantic, but you want to move on. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye. PJ, Katya, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brooke.
Coming up, after the silver screen, there was the small screen. Now there's the even smaller screen.
This is On the Media.
The phonograph and radio are really mighty nice. But now they brought out something new, a C&I device. I never get a break at all since this thing come along. Each time I alibi, this lie detector proves I'm wrong.
Television is the devil's doing. Brought me ruin, grief and woe. Television is the devil's doing. Television, it's gotta go.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Television is the devil's doing. Brought me ruin, grief and woe. Television is the devil's doing. Television, it's gotta go.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back in 2005, we ran a little piece about the future of mass media. It was a crackpot screed predicting all sorts of futuristic nonsense, like podcasts displacing radio listening and consumer-generated video aggregating vast audiences online. This was before the emergence of YouTube, of course, not to mention Hulu, Roku, and Netflix streaming. But the soothsaying business is not for the faint of heart. So while we were at it, we meditated on apocalypse.
For the moment, let's call it a hypothetical, but what if network broadcast television, the most powerful communications force in the history of mankind, the opiate of the masses, the home of desperate housewives, were to disappear?
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
Human sacrifice. Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Yep, a world without TV networks. Unthinkable. This was David Poltrack, head of research for CBS, imagining life not only without fresh episodes of CSI, sneak in the theme music, but without a place for advertisers to efficiently pitch their wares.
And if, in fact, that current system deteriorates to the point that advertisers and marketers abandon it, I don't see anything that's going to replace it, and the entire marketing infrastructure of the country and the economy is going to be diminished, and that's a lot bigger problem than just a network television problem.
He had that right. Even as more and more viewing is done online, except for search, the internet turns out to be a terrible advertising medium. But as to Poltrack's skepticism, and most everybody else's, about what we called the chaos scenario, all we were doing was looking at trends, the rapid ascension of digital technology on the one hand, and the rapid erosion of network audiences on the other. Back in 2005, that audience had been shrinking for a decade to a mere 16.5% of TV households in prime time. Today, only 11.5% of households are watching. The other 88.5% are doing something else. And yet advertisers are so desperate for any slender vestige of a mass audience, networks have been able to keep afloat by boosting the ad rate per viewer. Still, revenues are slipping and eventually will fall below the cost of producing the programming. Here's a canary in the coal mine. In the first quarter of 2012, NBC, despite a Super Bowl bonanza, showed an operating loss. We've seen the devastation in newspapers, magazines, book publishing, the recording industry, Hollywood. The chaos scenario imagines the end of broadcast as we know it by the year 2020. Well, we are halfway there. For more than 50 years, advertisers have gotten together with television networks every spring to do a dance called the Upfronts. The networks tout their upcoming programs and entice advertisers to buy ad time up front. This month's TV upfronts proceeded as usual, but this year the torch seems to be in the process of passing to a new generation. Sort of. The brand new digital new fronts are an acknowledgement that viewers also watch TV-like content over the internet. How many people? No idea. What are they watching? Unclear. And how much should advertisers pay to reach them? Not sure. But all these digital platforms did just announce their offerings, and Sahil Patel attended, so you didn't have to. Sahil, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
First, can you give us a bird's eye view of what the so-called new fronts look like?
It started out with Hulu, Google/YouTube, AOL, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Digitas. They're an advertising agency. So those were the six founding partners. Smaller content creators and distributors also wanted to get involved, so it eventually expanded to 15 or so different companies. NBC had the distinction of being the only network that was actually involved in it because they do have a lot of digital content properties. So they actually did have their own presentations at the new fronts.
Now, if this were the TV upfronts, the networks would trot out the big stars. What did the exhibitors at the new fronts have to offer?
Each of them trotted out celebrities who they got to create content for digital platforms. At the Yahoo New Front, Anthony Zucker, who's the creator of CSI, is creating this new movie that will be distributed in short clips over like 10 weeks. Hulu had Adrian Grenier. Seth Meyers was there for a cartoon that he is co-producing for Hulu. Richard Linklater's Up to Speed looks pretty interesting. That's on Hulu.
And there were bigger names still. Tom Hanks is producing a series. So the good news is that online video is sufficiently advanced as an advertising medium that there is at least now a marketplace.
That's exactly the case.
Vast amounts of content are consumed online, so that's a hopeful development.
Of course. For example, Comscore, which is one of the most prominent measurement services for online content, came out with their latest report for April, which said that Americans watched 37 billion pieces of online video content last year. Well, of course, a lot of that is, you know, short clips. There is also a significant amount of premium content that is being watched. Just going back to YouTube, their top channels are receiving 23 million unique viewers per month. That's not nothing.
So that's the good news. Let's move on to the bad news. Mm-hmm. If the broadcast and cable model are suffering in a 1,000-channel universe, what can we expect in terms of an ongoing business model in a zillion-channel universe?
Content companies, these exhibitors, have started out doing it the only way they really can, sign these influential people like Tom Hanks, like Adrian Grenier, like Seth Meyers to bring audiences over. And it's not just creators, but brands as well. For example, Machinima, which has one of the most loyal followings within the video game content community, has a really big channel on YouTube. So while it is a wide open playing field, there's only a certain select number of premium brands that have the capacity and the means to actually broadcast, for lack of a better term, to a wide audience online. But at the same time, the thing about digital, and I think this is one way that it differentiates itself from what broadcast and cable do, is they have the ability to create content that is more targeted to audiences. And it makes it easier to monetize that content where advertisers want to actually come on board and reach that audience.
One final obstacle, just discovery itself. Even a low-budget Hollywood film spends a minimum of $30 million and sometimes way north of $100 million to get people into the theaters. Mm-hmm. How do these shows get anyone to look at them in the absence of very, very substantial promotional budgets?
look at the companies that are actually involved in the new fronts. If 700 million people are on Yahoo on a monthly basis, there's at least an opportunity there to reach them. At YouTube's event at the Digital Content New Fronts, they actually announced that they were going to spend $200 million marketing their original channels.
There's one company we haven't mentioned yet, also a distribution platform that is reinventing itself in some respects as a studio, and that's Netflix, announcing new productions that it will stream and send out as DVDs. Did Netflix participate in the new fronts?
No. It's a little bit of a different animal. Their CEO, Reed Hastings, has basically talked about how he wants Netflix to become like a digital version of HBO. Pay a certain amount of money per month and you can get access to whatever content that Netflix has, but also original programs that they're creating, whether it's Lilyhammer that they announced recently or, you know, they bring back Arrested Development. But, you know, Netflix, they don't need this advertiser money.
Given all the obstacles I mentioned, isn't the subscriber model maybe the only one that has a chance to survive?
There is definitely value in there. Hulu has a subscriber model. There was a report out of the New York Post about how Google and YouTube are considering a paid subscription model where they would develop premium content exclusive to that. But at the same time, it's so early. This was the first event of its type within the digital space with this kind of reach, with this kind of participation. You know, you can't say for sure the digital space is not going to develop a model where it will be able to effectively grab ad dollars and also effectively reach audiences.
Sahil, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Sahil Patel is associate editor for Synopsis, an online trade magazine.
Alyssa Rosenberg, culture reporter for Think Progress, sees independently produced web TV as a gathering storm for Hollywood, even though she herself, for a long time, didn't see it coming.
As a critic, I was the person who came late to web television. It was my readers who, if I was complaining about something on network TV, they said, you should try this, you should try that. And I think the thing that network television has to reckon with is that people will no longer passively accept bad entertainment. You have some place like CBS, of course, which has shows like Two Broke Girls or Two and a Half Men that are huge hits, but that aren't sophisticated, that have much older audiences. And some place like CBS in 10 or 15 years could find itself walking off a cliff. If they were smart, they would start looking at web series, not as an alternative or a competitor, but as a developmental pool. You know, I don't think the problem is that the public doesn't think web television has credibility. These shows are finding their audiences, even if they're not making a lot of money, but that the people who are sort of the gatekeepers need to give them the recognition that they already deserve for the product that they're putting out.
It seems, though, that the challenges confronting this form are pretty daunting. First of all, there's the business model challenge, and second of all, there's the word-of-mouth challenge.
A web television series doesn't get an upfront presentation. It doesn't get to be presented at the Television Critics Association. These people can't afford to send out 400 screener copies to anyone who might conceivably be interested, and they find audiences anyway. That they can do that without any of the budget or the marketing or the distribution is, I think, a demonstration of potential more than challenge. If you could build strong channels for web television, it's perfect. If you have an hour at lunch and want to catch up with six of your favorite web shows and someone strings them together for you in a series and then launches something new at the end of it, this is television that you can literally fit in anytime you want. I think there's much more upside potential than we're seeing right now. We're at a time when we've established the floor, but we're not even close to establishing the ceiling.
Alyssa, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been lovely to be here.
Alyssa Rosenberg is a culture reporter for Think Progress and a correspondent for The Atlantic. Jane Espenson is no stranger to Hollywood, having written and produced for shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Game of Thrones, Battlestar Galactica, and currently ABC's Once Upon a Time. In other words, she's a geek goddess. But her latest project with co-creator Brad Bell is a web show, just a few minutes per episode, called Husbands, about two gay celebrities who, after spending a drunken night celebrating a new marriage equality law, wake up married to each other and decide to stay together to further the cause of gay rights.
So what do you two know about being married?
I never thought past wanting the right to do it.
So important. So abstract.
Okay.
What do married couples do first?
They have a fight.
Yeah, we've already done that.
We've already done that. They thrash cake on each other. Oh my God, I love it. It's so funny. No.
The show is incredibly popular and in the midst of shooting its second season. Jane, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And Brad, welcome to you too.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It isn't just a different form of distribution. It really is, in some ways, a radically different format. Every episode of season one is under 5 minutes. Was that considered an advantage, or did you just understand that's how most people use web video?
Well, I think that it was a product of its time. You know, a year ago, bite-sized content was a marketing advantage to wrap people in, but smart TVs are more and more prominent on the market, and eventually you'll turn on that entertainment box and sit down on the couch fully integrated to the web, and we will see internet content turning much more into what we know as television content with length and characters and scope and the production.
We're jumping on a horse that's like changing directions a lot, and that's part of the fun of doing content for the web is that we're trying to be really flexible. Will we keep that 2 minutes format? Probably not. We'll probably release this in longer pieces because the model is changing.
How does writing and pitching a show on your own compare to writing and producing for studio?
It feels very much like writing an episode of Buffy or Once Upon a Time. It's like, what do these characters want? How do we keep this to length? How do we make it producible? It's all the same questions. The thing that's different is the amount of involvement we have hands-on in the production. We sort of see this cradle to grave, whereas in TV, at a certain point, you hand your script over. Even if you've got a producer title, your involvement diminishes as the script goes through the machine.
So you and your crew funded the entire first season on your own, right?
I funded it on my own, yeah.
And then the second season, through Kickstarter, you asked potential viewers for $50,000. You ended up instead making $60,000. That still seems like a drop in the bucket.
It's a little droppy and a little buckety, but it's not too bad. I'd say that that paid for a third of what season two is costing. I would not have felt terribly sanguine about jumping into season two without the help of what the fans brought to us. We raised that 50 in a week. It was startling and gratifying.
It's certainly micro-budget by Hollywood standards, but I think that we are in a time when everything is having to get scaled back, and we are focused on how you make an incredible product for less.
I get that, but it doesn't strike me that funding the entire first season on your own and maybe somewhere around two-thirds of the second season on your own is much of a sustainable business model.
Yeah, ultimately it would be nice if it made the money that it takes to make it. But what we've done is we've gone ahead and done the initial investment, and we can say, look at the show. And then maybe people or some entity will want to help us continue making it. But right now, we just wanted the show to exist.
Do you get the impression that the web seems to have a larger percentage of female involvement than network TV? You've got shows like The Guild about a female gamer, The Misadventures of an Awkward Black Girl, Lisa Kudrow's Web Therapy.
There was a study done in this last year or so that only 19% of TV writers are females, which was a number that had fallen. We've been trying to storm this castle of network TV. Maybe we don't have to. Go build your own castle. And that's sort of what's happening online right now. Makes sense to me.
Was there a particular web program or series or experience you had that made you think, yeah, this is really where we should go?
There was a series called Very Mary Kate, interestingly, is also a female creator.
It's time for me to be my own person. From now on, no more Mary Kate and Ashley. It's just Mary Kate.
You didn't have to buy a new apartment.
I don't mean like there's no more Ashley. I just want to be independent. You can still totally exist if you want. You bought.
She's so funny, and it's very light. And I thought you could make a candy-coated quick little show and maybe give it some really grounded heart here and there, and that might work, actually.
Brad showed me Very Mary Kate. I hadn't been aware of it, and when I saw that, it was like, okay, yes, I get it. He had an idea for what the show could be about, but it didn't quite have yet like a driving reason that the story had to be told now. Shows about newlyweds have been sort of a staple of TV since I Love Lucy, And so when we added this notion of taking that in the modern world with same-sex newlyweds, just seems like the perfect product for the web. It's short, it's candy, it's fun, but it also can do something in the world. It can be relevant. And what else is the internet for?
Brad Bell and Jane Espenson, co-creators of the web series Husbands. Thank you both for talking to us.
Thank you.
I'm not going to be the first gay divorce since the new law. We have to stay technically married for a while.
Straight people do this all the time. In fact, if we weren't gay, this would be a hackneyed premise.
Thursday night, I got my baby at home. I turn the lights down low and turn the TV on. Channel 27 for the late movie. Pretty good thing, and it's called TV. 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 You know the song. I don't want to be afraid of a silver screen. If there's a one thing, baby, that you gotta see. Pretty good thing, and it's called a TV, TV.
Coming up, a huge chunk of your cable bill goes to one channel, one you may not even watch. Plus, are spoilers ever okay?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Reportedly, roughly 90% of Americans pay for cable, satellite, or fiber optic television. And for that privilege, they all pay what amounts to an $80 annual tax, according to industry analysts. But the recipient isn't any government. It's the Walt Disney Company. Disney plays the role of tax collector because it owns ESPN, the sports programming juggernaut. ESPN spends billions of dollars for broadcast rights to major sports and then passes that cost off to cable providers like Comcast, Cox, and Time Warner. Then they pass it off to you. In fact, the Wall Street Journal reported that in 2010, about 40% of your basic cable bill probably went towards sports programming, with ESPN taking the biggest slice. 20 minutes ago, you met Peter Kafka of All Things Digital. Well, we're dragging him back to discuss this. Peter, welcome to Segment C.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
ESPN is the dominant force in the industry. How did that come to pass?
It's a marvelous story. And if you remember back in the early 80s, late 70s, when ESPN was born, they had nothing.
And we're just minutes away from the first event on the ESPN schedule. That's the 1979 NCAA College Football Preview. Then we're going to follow that with two...
The amazing thing is people watched it. They were able to parlay that modest popularity into ever-increasing cable fees. They use those fees to go out and buy expensive programming. And they've since been able to cobble together a series of sports packages that if you like sports, you have to have.
But if you don't like sports, you also have to have, because you cannot get basic cable without ESPN. It is bundled into your service, whether you like it or not. And there have been rumblings for years on Capitol Hill about doing something about that and forcing cable providers to go a la carte. But that has been a non-starter till now. Why?
The interesting question is whether there's actually a huge demand to break the bundle apart. If you write for technology blogs like I do, you'll find lots of readers who will tell you they absolutely want to break up their cable bill and they want to just get the stuff they want to watch. But when consumers vote with their pocketbooks, they pay for cable year after year. Time Warner Cable and perhaps a couple other cable operators have actually offered a sort of sports-less package, and they haven't found many buyers.
What happens if the sports leagues themselves bypass ESPN and start making their offering directly to individuals online? I'm talking about subscribing, as I do, directly from Major League Baseball.
Even with those MLB rights, and MLB is pretty advanced when it comes to sports leagues, they have a carve-out that says we are not going to wreck these super lucrative local TV rights. That's where the big money is for these guys. We'll sell you additional baseball rights to stuff that you couldn't see normally in your geography, and that's fine too. So no one wants to break the model they have.
You can watch Breaking Bad in real time or time delayed on your DVR. You can get it through Netflix and you can binge on it or watch one show at a time. But that's not how people consume sports. They consume it in real time. It's kind of the last chance gas for the old mass audience. Is that what gives ESPN such clout?
It gives sports in general enormous clout with advertisers, sporting events and award shows, Grammys, Oscars, even things like American Idol, all have enormous import for the TV advertising ecosystem because you can still get lots of eyeballs there. That's separate from why consumers are paying for access to sports. They're paying for access to sports because that's the only way they can get it.
I got to tell you, Peter, the only reason I still have my cable subscription is ESPN. Everything else I do online. I'm prepared to be a cord cutter if I can get my sports a different way. Is the world going to accommodate me anytime soon?
There are a lot of entrenched interests that want to keep you paying for cable in the way that works for them. Your concerns are not really their concerns, at least right now.
Cable is going to survive and maybe even thrive because we just can't live without our live sports. Is that the bottom line?
You think about how much the world has evolved in the last 7 to 10 years technologically, again, pre-YouTube, pre-iPad, pre-iTunes. And in cable TV world, it looks exactly the same, just more expensive for the consumer. I don't think sports is the sole culprit here. They're the most obvious one. They take the biggest chunk, but they're representative of a system. I would hate to think that we're going to have nothing but the status quo for the next decade, but the track record suggests we will.
All right, Peter. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Peter Kafka covers media and technology for All Things Digital. So with the exception of sports, some breaking news, and the odd award show or reality TV finale, it seems we no longer watch TV as a community. David Carr, New York Times media reporter, says that doesn't much matter. But Matt Zoller-Seitz, TV critic at New York Magazine, says community matters a lot. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to be with you.
David, how much live TV did you watch in the month of May so far?
I watched 2 minutes and 1 second of the Kentucky Derby, and give or take the jockey who was weeping inconsolably, I guess I hung around for a minute or two. That was fairly riveting live television. But generally, I'm sort of a goose egg when it comes to the live demo, as they say.
But you're a TV watcher. You pointedly said in a recent New York Times column that you're not one of those who sniffs and says, well, one simply doesn't watch television. You watch it, but not in real time.
If I was missing out on television, I would be missing out. And I'm sort of the juiciest part of the culture right now. All the big ideas seem to be on the small screen. I just want to be able to program them and watch them on a platform of my choosing. Is that too much for a boy to ask?
Matt, what David's just described are the patterns of a TV viewer, but someone who's not doing it at the same time as everyone else, the way all this stuff used to be done.
We started to see that happen in the 90s when the networks began repeating certain shows on the weekends and in different time slots, and of course cable doing repeat views of shows all throughout the week. The cumulative audience became more important than the audience that saw it the first time. But there really just is no substitute to watching a show live, as I have discovered. Once I got on Twitter, you can see it. It's like a ticker tape or an EKG reading.
Describe for me the experience you're talking about here. You're watching TV live, and you've got your tablet or your laptop.
It depends on the show. Like a Mad Men or something where there's a lot of plot, a lot of thematic action happening, I'll usually concentrate on the show and do my note-taking during the commercial breaks. But other shows I will be kind of live tweeting, which it's part of the enjoyment for me and apparently for a lot of other people as well. And it does turn it into the virtual equivalent of watching a show in your living room with a bunch of friends.
Presumably this can only be done in real time because otherwise, how do you form a crowd?
Right. You know, I would say that even time shifting a little bit takes you out of that loop. And I would watch shows about, 10 to 15 minutes after their actual start time, because I wanted to be able to fast forward through the commercials. But that kind of takes part of the fun out of it. And it also opens you up to the possibility of spoilers. And I made the decision during the season finale of season 4 of Breaking Bad to stop doing that, because I left the room to take a bathroom break and returned, and something really big had happened. And I found out about it on Twitter before I actually saw it.
There's two trends here that seem to be moving in opposite directions. Matt, there's the real-time social viewing that you've described, which is on the rise. But the mega trend that's working in the other direction is the exodus to the DVR, that live viewing itself is diminishing. Is that not an unstoppable trend?
You cannot stop what's coming. DVR viewing is the second highest rated program on network every single night.
Viewing without commercials is a practical matter.
Yes, Dish Network announced a technology right before the upfronts. Hey, we can give you a product that's going to vaporize all the commercials. My concern as a consumer is that when the business model goes away, all this yummy programming that Matt and I really enjoy might go away. We've all been, you know, writing about and talking about network numbers. There is a steady trend line down, and social viewing in real time might be alleged, but I think, as you say, Bob, you can't really stop what's coming.
Is there even any data that suggests a relationship between the amount of social viewing that goes on and the overall popularity of a program?
No, but there is a definite relationship between the intensity, the level of detailed, enthusiastic scrutiny, and the enthusiasm of the viewership for that show. And that's arguably the thing that saved Community.
It has pulled shows back from the brink. These are days when hits are grown. They don't explode.
You have observed, David, that the very tools that Matt relies on for social viewing actually conspire against networks and cable in other ways. Can you tell me what you're talking about?
Well, I'm not the one who blew a whistle and said, hey, let's put all the great shows on Sunday night. The live experience is great, Matt, but a person only has so much time. Some stuff, big events, I'm happy to be there. The rest of the time, I'm going to store up what I want to and play it out at a time of my choosing. And let's say something like I'm hooked on Archer. Does it really matter when I watch Archer? If I put a hashtag on Twitter, people will gather. And the water cooler happens whenever you light a match on Twitter. It isn't necessarily right when the show's on.
That's true, but you do get a bigger bonfire when the show first airs.
Are we going to continue with this metaphor?
Right until it itself immolates, Bob.
Matt, David, thank you very much.
Nice to be with you, Bob.
Thank you.
David Carr writes about media for the New York Times, and Matt Zoller-Seitz is TV critic at New York Magazine.
You know, communal viewers can really wreck things for us time shifters. Their excited Twitter chatter about the great twist in last night's Mad Men can be a little frustrating if you haven't yet watched last night's Mad Men. Of course, you don't have to go on Twitter or Facebook, but you can't ignore the newsstand cover of Entertainment Weekly. This brave new world of ours is lousy with spoilers. New Yorker TV critic Emily Nussbaum had to face the consequences of live tweeting too enthusiastically while TV watching, giving rise to a phenomenon dubbed Nussbombing.
Well, Nussbombing, which was spelled Nussbombing, hashtag Nussbombing. Really, what it came down to is that I enjoy watching the NBC sitcoms that are constantly under threat, but are among my favorite shows.
Like 30 Rock.
Especially 30 Rock. And so when I watch 30 Rock, I would be seized with fascination with some particularly well-crafted zinger. And so I would tweet those, thus spoiling the show for other people, which is not really how people usually think of spoilers. People usually think of spoilers as basically exposing who shot JR or some big plot thing. But this really was a matter of, with a very beautifully constructed, extremely prickly sitcom like that, you can't tell too many of the lines without really wrecking the excitement for people. And so I have pulled back from this. I actually decided that what I would do was, while watching 30 Rock, I would choose one perfectly chosen, beautifully designed zinger, and I would send that one off. I would basically just spoil one joke, and this was my compromise.
And this is part of how your policy on how to handle spoilers has evolved. So when is it ever okay, or is it ever okay to deliberately spoiled.
Only in the case of Smash. No, with Smash, which is a horrible show, but an incredibly watchable show, it started well, but it quickly devolved into just like a nightmare of terrible narrative decisions and laughable performances. But nonetheless, I watch it with other people, which both heals the wounds of watching it, and at the same time, honestly, gives me a different kind of enjoyment, including a way of celebrating the little parts of it that actually do work. So while I watch Smash, I admit that I live tweet it with other people and we comment on what's going on. In a strange way, I think it improves the show. And because it really is such a terrible show, but also such a delightful and enjoyable one, I feel like this is a communal experience of Smash that in a way respects the kind of show it is.
Now, we've been talking a lot about live tweeting, but what is the statute of limitations on a spoiler? When is it okay to tell people that Rosebud was a sled?
I don't know the answer to that. And not only do I wish I did, everybody certainly who works in media wishes that they did. There's a difference between, to me, headlines, tweets, discussion groups, essays that people write, reviews. To a certain extent, there is a point at which the consumer has to protect themselves. But generally, I mean, I'd like to say that I have a policy on this, but my policy is to try not to ruin things for everyone else, but at the same time, do exactly what is pleasurable for me.
Okay. So with that Solomonic wisdom, I want you to split this baby. We nearly had an office fist fight this week because one producer said to another that the finale of a show she was watching, The Killing, would be a huge letdown. He didn't think it was a spoiler. He wasn't saying what actually happened. She said that it was because he'd primed her for a certain emotional reaction.
To me, that's not only not a spoiler, it's actually part of a different phenomenon that myself and Adam Sternberg developed at New York Magazine that was called the undulating curve of shifting expectations. To me, that doesn't actually qualify as a spoiler, that actually qualifies as a gift to another person in which you lower their expectations such that they enjoy what happens next more. Because basically, if you say to somebody, yeah, Cabin in the Woods is, it's good, you should see it, but it's not a perfect movie, that person is guaranteed to take a great deal more delight in the movie. On the other hand, The Killing is such an incredibly fraught subject that perhaps everyone should have just decided not to speak about it at all, because people get extremely upset about that show, and so there's just an emotional price to be paid.
Now that we're living in the age of the recap, you know, TV's really good and online discussions of it are sophisticated and they're entertaining in their own right, to some extent, having to write around spoilers impedes the conversation, so does our spoiler phobia just seem like a silly hang-up?
I really don't think it's a silly hang-up. I mean, honestly, without exaggeration and realizing that I sound like a lunatic, some of the single best moments of my life have been surprises on television. I wrote an article a long time ago, very much pre-Twitter, where I'd interviewed Joss Whedon, and he talked about the idea of surprise as a holy emotion. And honestly, despite the fact that it's become harder not to be spoiled, and spoilers come in so many different ways, I still do actually agree with that.
You've experienced the holy emotion from yes. Joss Whedon's own programs.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of different shows in which I've experienced this kind of ecstatic experience of, especially with television, which you watch for a long time, and then basically 20 hours in, something happens that just grabs you by the throat and startles you. You feel this tingling sensation. You didn't see where it was going. It's so poignant. I mean, I can talk about this both on great shows like Buffy, like the end of the second season. And the same thing, honestly, is true on a show like Melrose Place, where I got up and danced during the scene where What's-Her-Name pulled off her wig, which I feel is no longer a spoiler since it was now decades ago. But still, that's something that I feel like people should still be able to experience. And it's part of a lot of different kinds of television viewing. That said, I think it's important for both things to exist. I mean, I feel very grateful because when I write the kinds of essays that I've been writing, I feel like there is a buyer beware quality to them. If I'm going to write about a television show, I'm going to write about the episodes that have aired. I do try to bear this all in mind, but it's basically we're all walking through this universe in which surprise can be spoiled, and we each have to find our own code in order to cope with that.
Emily Nussbaum, you are guided by integrity and art. Sometimes they conflict.
That is so wise.
Emily Nussbaum writes about television for The New Yorker.
She's so nice, isn't it? She's my TV mama. One with the big wide screen. Every time she loves me, man, she makes me scream.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.